Yes, 33.
This is the WGXE Afternoon Show with Sarah and Noah and Melinda. And today we've got Deborah Meyer with us in the house. Deborah Meyer is a resident of Hillsdale. She's a Columbia County resident. She has spent decades working in public education as a teacher, as a principal, as a writer, an advocate. She ranks among the most acclaimed leaders of the school reform movement in the U.S., often considered the founder of the small schools movement. She has been one of the most important voices in U.S. educational thought for the past few decades. In 1987, Meyer was the first educator to receive a MacArthur Genius Award. She is currently a senior scholar at NYU's Steinhardt School. She's the author of a number of books, and she currently maintains an online correspondence with for Ed Week with Diane Ravitch. It's called Bridging Differences. I think there's probably a lot of other things I could say in that bio, but was that all correct, Deborah?
Good. I also had raised three children who went through New York City public schools.
We were just hearing interviews that Studs Terkel had done. We were just hearing that in the last hour, and there was a woman he was talking to who worked at home and was devaluing her work at home, and then she said she had raised a daughter, and he said, "Well, that's the hardest work of all."
No.
Disagree.
Part of the reason that we reached out to you, Deborah, was in a little this week in particular was in response to some of what we were reading in the news. So I'm gonna start there. Last week, the Boston consultant firm put forward a proposal to close 40 public schools in Philadelphia in the next year. The proposal then has them closing five more public schools each year for 5 years. Sort of similar to what's happening in other cities around the country where public schools are being replaced by charter schools in what some people describe as privatization of school systems around the country. You mentioned in a blog post recently that at the time that you wrote your book, Will Standards Save Public Education, that you were at the time, quote, oblivious to the attack on the idea of a public system itself. And in an interview a few years back, in a conversation about the standards movement, someone asked you how you would go about it if you were in charge. Your answer at the time was that what was needed before anything was a real conversation about the purposes of our enormous dedication and investment in public education. So I sort of wanted to start there, thinking, and just ask you why public schools?
Because if we don't know where we're going, any road will get you there. I think that's in Alice in Wonderland or something. I'm assuming that the purposes of public education are public, that while it also serves our individual interests, the reason we require everybody to pay taxes for schools is that we think it's for the good of all of us. And it isn't just a question of my getting ahead of you if I go to a better school or who's higher up in the ladder or something. It's that we have some concern about society as a whole. And practically, for the last few hundred years, well, probably since human beings were invented, there has been some way in which one generation passes on its messages to the next. Through most of history, it was informally done. And that is still the predominant way we pass on our values. But it is only in the last 100 years or so that we've required, I sometimes say, incarcerated all children for at least 12 years. We've confined them against their wishes because we think it is mandatory that everybody get an education. And for that matter, when I was born, a majority of Americans didn't start high school. So it's this whole stuff we talk about students dropping out, they were just beginning to drop in when I was born. So there has been an enormous change, partly because other institutions did the job for us. If you lived in a small town, you knew a lot about how institutions worked and how democracy worked and who was rich and who was poor. And you knew the fundamentals of your job, and most people went on to do whatever their parents did for occupation. So both it's most essential purpose to me is to preserve and nurture and expand the idea of democracy, because it's not a natural idea. We're not willy-nilly growing up to be good citizens of a democratic country. The idea of democracy is very complicated. Most human history, it's very fragile institution, and it rarely lasts very long. And we don't pay much attention to it. If you walked into the average school in America, you wouldn't have the slightest idea that one of their purposes is to help people understand the quality and the nature of democracy. And so I think that's the thing that worries me most. I don't know that going to school can change for everybody the nature of the workplace, because that's something that I hope democratic citizens will start trying to figure out, is where should we be going in terms of work. There aren't enough good jobs in America right now. If everybody did graduate with a master's and a doctorate, we wouldn't know what to do with them all.
So it seems in some ways, well, I guess it would be helpful to understand a little bit how charter schools fit into the, when we talk about the public education system, how charters fit into there, because I do think it's a little bit confusing, because charter schools are public in some ways, and really understanding the distinction and how the idea of choice fits in there. I know in some of your writings have been useful for me in kind of understanding the difference.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, every state has a different system, so it's impossible to talk about the subject nationwide. And people get mad at me because I'll say something, and they say, but in our state, it's different. When it was first brought up, it was in a way in response to people on the general liberal left about trying to expand democratic ideas, and that public schools were too standardized, and they were too work-oriented rather than worrying about the larger picture of human beings, the arts, social justice, and so forth. And then somewhere along the way, they were kind of mom-and-pop stores, three teachers would get together with three parents, and they're publicly funded. That was the idea, that you would get money per child. And you'd get slightly less money than actually the regular system, so that it wouldn't be hurting everybody else. But then you were much freer about how to spend your money. And within a very short time, and I haven't tracked it down, the idea turned not from mom-and-pop stores to Walmarts. And literally, because Walmarts is one of the largest chains of charter schools. In fact, the largest change is a chain run by some Turkish religious group called Gulen. Hmm. I mean, any case, they have public money, so in that sense, they're public. And there is some public regulation regarding who they have to serve and so forth. But they are privately controlled by their own private boards of education. Sometimes these are profitable organizations, and sometimes they're nonprofits. But it isn't that the public decides how to spend that money. And that means they can pay people on a different scale. It means they can try to keep only inexperienced teachers who don't have to be paid as well. And that's one way they can make more money. Today, what you have is a number, I'd say most charters today are run by chains, who, therefore, they're just, as far as I can see, almost as standardized as the ordinary public schools are. And they spend, unless they can get additional money from rich people, they spend less per child. So their class sizes are not smaller. There's nothing, that... there's nothing about them that couldn't be done within the public sector. Hmm. And I worked for years in two school systems in New York and in Boston, where we had schools of choice that were regular public schools. And I think that's, if we want choice, and there's arguments for and against choice, but if we want choice, that can be done within the regular ordinary schools. You don't have to have privatized part of the system. And a lot of these private schools, when they go out of business, you know, it's like restaurants. When they go out of business, the difference is, though, that the kids are not like food. I mean, the kids have to switch to another school. So it also is very disruptive in children's lives. First, they close a big public school, and the kids lose all their teachers. Mm-hmm. And then they go to a charter school, which after 3 or 4 years, someone loses interest in it, or they decide you can make more money somewhere else and move that charter somewhere else. And the kids, you know, have to get used to a whole bunch of new people. Mm-hmm. So I just think it, and none of them have any obligation, not only obligation to teach democracy, they're not organized democratically themselves. So they have less likely, it's not impossible to...
It's so interesting because the way you describe the early conversations around charter school do sound a lot like the kinds of small schools that you were starting in New York City, and those and that idea that there could be a way within the public realm to have a little bit of autonomy and a little bit of for innovation, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. but still be held accountable publicly, and how that has transformed so quickly within charter schools, and it's hard to track that because it happens so quickly.
Yeah. And this question of, which has been easier to do because one of the new reform ideas, when you said I'm known as a reformer,
yeah, I thought, that word.
Actually, nowadays I'm known as an anti-reformer. But when they take over these big buildings, that's because the mayor decides these things. It's no longer an elected school board. So there is, you know, every 4 years you have a new mayor, but most of the people who send their kids to public schools are not the majority of voters, and they're actually, since they tend to be low income and minority families, they're a little less likely to vote even. So turning it over to the mayors, who have a lot of friends who would like to run charter schools, they tend to pay their administration much better than public schools. They don't tend to pay teachers very well, but they pay the principal of one of the small chains in New York gets close to $500,000. Principal makes maybe $120,000 in New York. So it's, and you know, they, some of them pay their board members whom they choose, and it's, and then the parents in the building that the charter is gonna move into are all up in arms, because it means they lose their art room or they lose their music room and they're more crowded and the class sizes have to go up. And the mayor takes no responsibility in New York City for what happens in the regular public schools. His answer is they're not doing well, he'll close them and start charters. And if you call the Board of Ed and say, I can't get into any school because they've closed so many public schools that there's long waiting lists for kindergartens in Manhattan. There's just hundreds of kids who can't get into any of their neighborhood kindergartens. And the mayor's answer, or the Board of Ed answer, is, well, you should try to look for a charter school. So they've invested their reputations and everything else in dismantling the public sector. The school I founded in East Harlem, Central Park East, has always shared the building with several schools, but now they're being asked to this year, they were required to take in a charter school, and they have less space and larger class sizes, because if you have fewer rooms, even if you're willing to invest your money more in making class sizes smaller, if there's no room for them, you can't do it. So it's kind of like a recipe for making sure that you can claim that the private schools, the charter schools, are better than the public ones. Mm-hmm. And then the charter schools have the advantage also of, how shall I put it, encouraging parents whose children are not doing very well to go elsewhere. In some states, they actually can make them leave. They have to sign a contract, and it says in it, if you don't do the following things, you can be kicked out. But in New York State, it doesn't work that way. But there's nothing like sitting down with a parent and saying, I'm sorry, we're just unable to educate your child. But, you know, it's a so, and you know, it's just a fact that they lose a lot of kids on the way up, so that their graduation data is questionable. They serve many fewer children who come speaking a second language, and many fewer children who are getting special education resources. So then when you're comparing those two schools that are in the same neighborhood, you're comparing apples and oranges.
Debbie, do you feel at all like the alternatives that you created in New York City have somehow been co-opted and changed into a different kind of, that the idea of choice and reform has been taken over by, I know in Philadelphia as well as in New York, the people that they hire to administer these schools, a lot of the time in Philadelphia, it sounds like they're coming from a finance and business background where they're looking for cost savings and mm-hmm. where they can get out of mm-hmm. union contracts, what can't be unionized, what they can, how
they're
they
true
can,
believers. You yeah. know, the, at best I can say they honestly believe that the market model works best for everything. And so that they're as invested in the idea of the market economy as much as they're invested in education. And they believe in the long run that all good comes out of business-like marketplace solutions. But I tell you, there's another part of this, and that is the testing obsession. And they're connected, but
discuss that connection between the states coming in and requiring a testing regime and the dismantling of a public
yeah.
school.
Well,
how does that happen?
It doesn't have to, by the way. I mean, but they're connected in the way that they say business is accountable. And we have a clear way of measuring, you know, accountability. And the schools need another clear way that can't be biased. I can't come before my board of governors, my company. Of course, you can, actually, as we know. And say we're doing fine when we're not doing fine. Just a few years ago, in fact, they all did say we're doing fine, and they weren't doing fine. But their claim is that we can't do that in the private sector if we're operating business-like, and we therefore have to develop a system where we don't have to depend on educators to tell us how well the kids are doing. And it has to be objective and standardized, and every child has to do the same one. So tests become not just a way of helping you see an aspect of child's growth that you want to keep track of, but of actually being the profit or loss statement. And so now in New York, I don't know, they probably spend, it's not just that the test, so first of all, they spend about 20 days a year being tested, the beginning of the year, at the end of the year, and then there are benchmark tests so you can see how well you're doing between times, and then there are a great many schools, especially if they're serving low-income children, in which practically the only thing they study all year are how to take tests. That is, they work on test prep. And when I was teaching, test prep was illegal. Isn't that amazing? Mm-hmm. The test company said you could not, were not allowed, because they were trying, mm-hmm. they said in order to compare children, they all have to be equally unfamiliar with the test. So they, right before you took the test, you gave a practice test to children to teach them how to fill in the bubble. And then you put that practice test aside, and then you took the real test. Mm-hmm. And now, of course, you take those practice tests all year long. And so a lot of schools, because teachers can lose their jobs now because of children's test scores, schools can be closed because of children's test scores, kids can be held over because of the test scores, so forth and so on. And so it's hard for people not to narrow the curriculum to what is being tested. So a lot of libraries have been closed. You don't need to read lots of books. What you need to read is lots of paragraphs. And you don't need art and music because I used to argue that the purpose of learning to read is so that you can appreciate music. But apparently the reason to do only justification of music is if it improved your reading or math scores. So most kids in this country in low-income schools, if they get any art and music, it's once a week, one or the other. So one semester you get music, and one semester, and it's one period a week. And then, as I say, they're closing libraries. Then they've very few kids get the kind of phys ed that once was, you know, it's very important for children to lose weight and nutrition. But phys ed has disappeared, except for the fact that the teacher might take some kids out in the yard and play with them, but phys ed teachers are not much in demand. And then a lot of schools have eliminated recess, so that kids are literally in an incarceration mode from 8:30 in the morning to 3 o'clock, and this includes four-year-olds. I started off as a Head Start and kindergarten teacher, and I go into Head Starts and kindergartens all over the country. And if they are low-income communities, the Head Start looks like second grade used to look, with desks there and kids filling in bubbles. And then there may be a 40-minute period in which they have what they call choice time, which children have some semblance of choice. Generally things that you can sit at a desk and do, though. And, you know, it's this, the very children who most need to broaden their perspective of what's possible in life are being, in their name, in the name of civil rights, we are really destroying the lives of children from low income and poverty. And meanwhile, we're reducing the amount of money to schools. I was just at a meeting today of a foundation whose goal is to get every child ready for college. And I thought, meanwhile, colleges now have been priced out of the range of most kids. And it's so to imply that that the whole 12 years is for the purpose of getting them into college, mm-hmm. at a time when we are reducing the spaces in college and increasing the cost of college, and in which more and more people, as you were saying, Noah, are out of work, the families are out of work, the kids can't get jobs. I mean, it's a phony, and it seems to me we blame teachers and kids for failing the country when we have set impossible obstacles in their way and called it reform.
Makes Amen.
Me angry.
Well, I wonder if we could dig into that just a little bit about what, when I read earlier that you were a leader in the education reform movement, what reform did mean and how it's, and what it means now. What is that, what kind of connotations does that word have now?
Well, you know, up until, I would say, between 1960 and 1980, there was actual a reform movement going on in this country that was slow and gradual, and it was around things like teachers, more authority to teachers. You know, up until 1940, teachers were not unionized, and they were, you know, especially elementary school teachers, I can't tell you how much they were looked down upon and how disrespected they were. So there began to be more respect for teachers, more possibilities of parents being able to walk into schools. When my children started schools, parents were not allowed into most schools. They were considered, disruptive, at least in urban areas. I think that may not have been true in suburbs. And there was more of a kind of a personal, that young people are educated by people. It's the relationships between people. It's working next to people. That the most powerful form of learning is, in a way, an internship, where you learn in the company of someone who is more expert. So there were all kinds of schools started that had multi-age classes, in which older kids worked with younger kids, in which you learned in a lot of other settings, in which kids did projects. And I don't mean it was the norm, but it was a growing movement. And there was even a period of about 10, 15 years which people really all agreed that tests were not a good way to go. And somewhere, and so what reform meant was really trying a different way of having parents, teachers, and children relate to each other, to build a community in which the education came from all sides. It came from the environment, it came from inside the school, it came from older kids, younger kids. And then a lot of its roots were in John Dewey, Jean Piaget, and people would come to this country from all over the world, including China and Japan, because they heard that we were the forefront of educational reform, and that America was the place where creativity took place, where inventions took place, because we didn't have the European or Asian form of schooling. And I always thought that was amusing, because we were even then the exceptions. But then along came this train coming down the tracks with enormous corporate money behind them. It's a little like, what's this Supreme Court decision about? Money, you know. Oh, remind me now. You know, that decision which allowed rich people to put their money into politics. But putting your money into schools is a way of influencing society. If you can take over the school system with your money. And so even though public money was 90% was public money, if the Gates, all these big foundations put in each 1-2% of piece, that was, they controlled the system.
Yeah. Diane mentions in her exchange with you that it's almost like we're going back to a 19th century model where private wealthy citizens funded schools as charities, kind of.
Yeah.
Because the big corporate money will only get behind, they'll only put money into a system that is a charter school system. I mean, there's no, I don't know how they would put money behind a public school system, but they don't have any faith in the public school system.
Yeah, well, they put money behind it to kill it. So, it does remind me, if you read some of the 19th century Dickens, in which the rich person comes in and talks to the poor little children, the trustees of this, you know, the poor house or whatever, and everybody caters to that person. And we really, you're right, I hadn't thought we were going back to the school as poor house, as warehouse, and children more and more educated, more mechanically. The teachers now literally have scripts to read, and scripts at the heart of teaching is responding to each child and listening carefully to what they're really asking. You know, when someone's trying to teach you to do something on the computer for the first time, they get sometimes annoyed because they know exactly what they're telling you to do, but you don't know, you can't figure out what they're telling you to do and what you're doing wrong. And that's the scripted lesson. So the teacher is just annoyed at the kids because she has no time for listening to them, because the script is done by an expert. And she is just carrying out that work. But, you know, a lot of teachers in the first year or two may not mind it as much, and if they plan to leave anyway at the end of the third year. So it's, you know, it's not a big handicap. And the other thing one of you mentioned was that unions are not just a handicap to companies because of their effect on schooling itself, but because of their political influence. So at a time when rich people can give all the money they want to politics, the only other money politicians can reach in an organized fashion is the money that comes from unions. And that was the backbone of the Democratic Party for many years. That was where they got their money. And also from the people who are union members. Unions organized their members to make phone calls and so forth. So getting rid of the teachers' union, which is probably the most powerful single union left in America, is also...
has broad political implications.
Yeah.
So, Debbie, I think we're going to go to take a brief break with a song, and then but stay right where you are, because I think we've got more. We want to hear a little bit more.
If you're just tuning in, this is the WGXE Afternoon Show with Sarah and Noah and Melinda, and we're joined today by Debra Meyer, and we're talking about public education. And we were just talking a little bit about, we were talking about so much. We were talking about assessment and some of the test mania that's gone on in schools. And one of the questions that we wanted to ask you, Debra, was about your longtime advocacy for localism, for decisions about curriculum and pedagogy being made as close to the classroom as possible. I actually was reading an early correspondence between you, or not so early, but early when they were on your blog, Bridging Differences, a early correspondence between you and Diane Ravitch, where I think she called you on some contradiction you had made, and you said to her, you said, sometimes I prefer local rights, sometimes state rights, sometimes private rights, and other times federal rights, just not all in one place. I know I'm inconsistent, so then is the Constitution. But then you said, but when it comes to how we raise our children, when it comes to whose history is true, I fall back stubbornly on being as close as I can to viewing localism as my bottom line, with few exceptions. What we were just talking about off the microphone was about sort of how some of the where the limits of that kind of localism. We were talking about Brown versus Board of Education and segregation and desegregation in schools, and thinking about at what point do we need to have consensus to temper the unwisdom of the people, and at what point do we need to put faith in localities.
After all, the Constitution itself is, and especially the Bill of Rights, was a statement in some ways of lack of total trust of what we would do if left to our own devices. So, whether it's gun control or any one of the 10, amendments, there's contradictions between saying the people shall decide, but there are some things they're not allowed to do, even if they want to. And I think the purpose of education is to teach the young to exercise judgment, because that's what adults in a democracy have to do, exercise good judgment. And they can't possibly learn that from adults who are not allowed to exercise judgment. I just think that's a contradiction. It's like saying, I'm going to be taught to drive a car by people who don't know how to drive cars. And so it seems to me that we keep being afraid of this question, that in the end, we're stuck with human judgment. No matter how many other things we have, when I use a test and how I use it, still it's human judgment. And so I want decisions made. My default position is decisions should be made by those who have to carry them out, mm-hmm. and those who are most affected by it. So it's the child and the teacher and the parent. That's my default. Then I think, because I have more money or other forms of power, it may look like we all are the same, and each one of us can worry about our child and ourself, but there has to be some monitoring. And so I can understand why the principal has certain power that the average teacher doesn't, although I think there are other ways of solving that by making the school itself a democracy, mm-hmm. so that everybody is monitoring everybody in a way. And that's why I'm for small schools. It's largely because it's much, much easier. You stack the deck much more in favor of people hearing each other and listening to each other and taking responsibility for each other in a small school. It's very hard to take responsibility as a classroom teacher in a large school because how am I going to know what's going on in the other classes?
And so how did you go about in the schools that you created creating that sense of a community between parents, teachers, and students?
Well, start with we made or the schools were young, were small. Mm-hmm. And the size I argued for was a size so that at least the staff can all sit around one table. Mm-hmm. And nobody sitting behind you, so that everybody has got to be paying attention to each other and everybody is looking at each other. And that over time, that enables you to operate without any subcommittees. The only subcommittees or committees there should exist and ever have existed in my schools were for a particular purpose. We're having something on Friday evening, so three people say, well, we'll work on that. But otherwise, it's a committee of the whole time. And if someone said to me, and the staff is responsible for it. So if someone wants to make a dentist appointment after school on Wednesday, and that's when the staff always meets, the norm was the staff would say to them, skip school if you have to, because we can put someone in your classroom who will do a good job. But nobody but you can represent you at the staff meeting. And we are all accountable for what happens in each other's classrooms. What happens to each other's children. And then as far as possible that we bring parents into that. Now, since parents can't be there on the whole during the daytime, it's more complicated. But we do set aside a lot of time for people to get to know each other, the two important sets of adults in a child's life. And, you know, at Mission Hill, for example, we only had 180 students, kindergarten through eighth grade. And once a month, we had an evening where families got together, and we figured out a way to provide food, and the kids got together, and then they went into each other's they went into their classrooms and chatted with other parents, and that everybody felt they were a member of the community and knew each other. And teachers spent twice a year had long family conferences with each family, and grandmothers would come and. Older brothers, so that you try to figure out who in this family that, you know, they're all important. And that's true for high school kids, too. There are a lot of important adults that really want to be powerful. And kids see them getting increasingly less powerful. And schools play a role in depowering parents who are so important. I mean, I'm, you know, after a few years, I may love the kids who were in my class, but they, you know, my devotion to them never can be as great as people in their family. And they have to fight for this kid. They have to know this kid. And so we have to bring them in the picture. And over time, which is also why not only the small school, but teachers staying with the same kids for several years, and parents of the sixth grade kid knowing still the kindergarten teacher, because it takes time for trust to build. And yet some level of trust has to exist. Even if you pretend, I pretend I trust you, because you just cannot, I can't hire a babysitter even if I don't trust her, because I don't care how detailed the instructions are, I leave. If that babysitter is a dishonest or dishonorable person, she has too much power to hurt my child. So I shouldn't leave my house if I can't find a babysitter I trust. And you shouldn't let be, you must be uncomfortable if you leave your child in a school that you have no trust for. So it's provisional at first. When the parents first bring their kids to us, they kind of like us. That's why they came to our schools, because our schools were schools of choice. And in a district that tried to make all the schools of choice. And after 10 years, every child had a right to go to their immediate neighborhood school or any one of the schools of choice where there was openings. And this was East Harlem, and so there was 20 buildings with 53 schools. And it meant the neighborhood school was a school of choice too, because if you didn't choose, if you chose it rather than one of the schools of choice. It was your choice. And it just, that itself also changes, shifts the relationship. You can assume that the parents stick with this place because they think there's a shot at trusting these people. And you know, partly what, you know, as a parent, the most important thing to me was, did this teacher like my kid? You know, their pedagogy and their curriculum were second. After is my child in a room where the teacher likes him, respects him, or is he in a room where the teacher doesn't like him and doesn't respect him and doesn't respect me? I mean, there's no question she could be a teacher does who's totally steeped in my viewpoint, but doesn't respect me or my kid, and I want him out of there.
And, well, it's interesting to read your, when you write about education policy and imagining a way forward or the other way forward, and really imagining what it might take to build real public schools that really work for people. It's amazing how much your work stays so close to the children and to that notion of trust at every scale, so that not only between you and a parent or you and a kid, but then also at the district level.
Yeah. It's what also made schools so fascinating to me. I mean, I miss every day I'm not there, because a community like that is, and I think all the teachers in our schools felt that way, that the power of those communities, intellectually, socially, morally, and emotionally, is so enormous. I mean, just intellectually, you know, kids, if you don't take kids and their parents seriously, you don't realize that something you think may be just cute or is really profound. And if you take it seriously,
the creative potential is extraordinary.
Yeah, I mean, I learned so much. And the first time I was reading the kids a story about when we first went to the moon, and it said, this little account said, when the man got to the moon, he looked up in the sky and he saw the earth. Pardon me. He looked up in the sky and saw the earth. And I thought, no, if he's up in the moon, he would look down. And so I said to the kids, I don't understand this. If he's on the moon, wouldn't he look down? And one of the kids said, well, stand up, Mrs. Meyer. And I stood up and he said, well, now look down. What do you see? And I said, my feet. And he said, yeah.
Oh, that's
and it
good.
Was, you know, in other words, we were all kind of, that's true of, I mean, my fascination with mathematics. And the higher math came from teaching 4 and 5 year olds to think about mathematics. And the first time I realized how complicated the idea of 15 was, or 7, counting 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, this finger isn't 7. And in any case, it just can be an exciting place for the families, the community. And I think schools are, a local school can be our last great hope for democracy.
Well, Debbie, unfortunately, we're out of time. We have to go on to the next, we're at the time for Al Jazeera. Is that what comes on now?
It is, but we
Al Jazeera.
But we do hope, Deborah, to have, especially, we're a new community radio station here, and so as we think about how to create some really responsible conversations here about what's going on in the school districts within our listening area, we do hope to have you on in the future, as everything comes up, as it does.
It would be fun to
have a
regular time so people would know, for a call-in show about, and have a few local teacher.
People who are working in the schools here.
And say, you know,
here.
On Friday, next Friday it's going to be elementary school, and, you know.
Let's do it.
Yes.
Thank you again
Thank
so
you.
Much.
Thank